Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today we take you to the Portland Museum of Art for a roundtable discussion hosted by Maine Public Radio's own Keith Shortall, NPR's former Russia correspondent Corey Flintoff, and Cuba's state television anchor Christina Escobar consider the meaning of public media and its impact around the world. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and this program will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to hear the program again at any time and to access many other past archived Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speakers today is Mark Vogelzang, President and CEO of Maine Public.
Hi, everyone. This is tremendous. My name is Mark Vogelzang. I'm the president and CEO of Maine Public. We're delighted to see you all tonight here. And I, first of all, want to thank our great friends and partners at the Portland Museum of Art. This is so much fun to be able to be in their auditorium. I know that many of you are proud supporters of, board members of, patrons of the PMA, and we think this is great. It's a terrific thing that we're able to bring a high-level conversation to the stage tonight, and I want to thank a few folks. First of all, our sponsors. This is public broadcasting, after all. We don't have advertisers. We have sponsors. and we want to thank Ocean View at Falmouth and Highland Green for their support, and then also the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs at Colby College. So, of course, every organization can't do without fabulous trustees. So could I have our Board of Trustees stand up, past, present, future, stand up? I was kidding about the future ones, but, you know, if you let me know. I would like to turn to our guests for the evening. They're going to come on up. First of all, the most familiar name and voice on the panel is news director Keith Shortall. Keith has been with Maine Public Radio for over 28 years. You hear Keith on Maine Calling. You hear him on the Across the Aisle political weekly political panel. And tonight, he's going to interview Christina and Corey. Come on, both of you, come on up. I first met Christina Escobar as part of Maine Public's educational travel trip to Havana earlier this year. She was dynamic in a group setting, and we thought more of you would like to have the chance to get to know her and appreciate her perspective as the evening television anchor for the network of the state broadcast network in Cuba. She is a specialist on Cuba-U.S. relations. She's chief correspondent in the Cuban National Television Network. She covered all of the events in Washington and Havana since December of 2014. She, Christina, was the first Cuban journalist to enter and ask questions in a White House press briefing, and that was in May of 2015. She's going to talk a lot about media in Cuba because she hosts a regular show about media in Cuba, and she has been called one of the most influential young journalists in Cuba. And to my right here, Corey Flintoff. We've gotten to know Corey's distinctive voice, and more importantly, his deep, solid reporting for many, many years on NPR. Corey's been a radio journalist for over 40 years. He started not at Maine Public Radio, but on the other side of the country in Alaska, which is so cool. And he and Christina talked today to our staff at noon before they went on Maine Calling. He's covered wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Ukraine, revolution in Egypt, and of course, he's got a unique perspective on Vladimir Putin's Russia. So, Keith, Christina, Corey, let's welcome them.
Thank you, Mark, and welcome, everybody. It's great to see you. If you've never seen me before, I know what you're thinking. Yes, I sound taller. We're we titled this discussion tonight, Two Views on Public Media. And the reason for that is that, as you know, we identify ourselves, that is, Maine Public, the local affiliates, NPR. We identify ourselves as public media. It used to be public radio, but it's bigger now. It's public media. And in the course of preparing for this discussion tonight, I discovered that Christina also describes what the system of state government-owned broadcasting in Cuba also as public media. So I thought we could use that as a connecting point to talk about the different perspectives we have on journalism and the state's role in that. And of course, given all of the stories, international news stories that are swirling around U.S. and Russian relations, around U.S.-Cuban relations, the changes that have happened there, are happening there, and the investigation into the alleged interference by the Russians into the 2016 election, the bizarre story about sonic attacks on U.S. diplomats in Cuba, so many things to talk about, and it's really going to be interesting to hear the perspectives of people who have been and report in those places. So I'm excited about that. I'd like to start out, though, tonight by finding out a little bit more about the journeys that these two journalists have taken to get where they are today. I want to start with Corey Flintoff, who, as Mark mentioned, is from Alaska, and you got your start in radio in Alaska. How did that happen?
Well, I had actually no interest in journalism, and especially in radio journalism, when I went to a very small town in southwestern Alaska called Bethel. But I asked someone there what you do for, where you look for jobs, and they said, well, go to the local public radio station. They always need somebody. And it turned out that this particular station, because this is an area that's largely a Yupik Eskimo population, this particular radio station was bilingual, Yupik in English, and the only thing you had to do, Alaska generally, and this may be true of Maine as well, was a low-qualification state. That is to say, you didn't really need enormous qualifications to get a job there. The only thing you needed to do to get a job at KYUK, which is my first radio station, was learn to give the station ID in Yupik. So I got somebody to coach me, and I can still do it. Ni chugni uchi, ni chugni sutkun, KYUK mak mani mam telefon. That got me my first job in radio. And so that's it.
I bet everybody in here would say that Maine is very dependent upon its public broadcasting, but I've heard you say that Alaska, perhaps more than any other state, really is dependent upon public radio.
Yes, actually there are 16 public radio stations throughout Alaska, and of course they're primarily in remote areas, far out on the coasts and on the Arctic Ocean and so forth. And in fact, those are places that don't have normal commercial broadcasting as we know it. So public radio is their primary source of not only news, but cultural transmission. These are primarily Native American areas, and so they rely on their stations as sources of their native language, transmitters of their native culture, transmitters of oral tradition and things like that. Very important.
How did starting out in a place like Alaska shape the way that you pursued journalism later? I mean, did it give you certain skills that you might not have had you started at WBEZ in Chicago?
Yeah, well, I bet Christina can talk to this too. In my case, it was cross-cultural communications, because when I started at a bilingual station, I had to learn how to communicate with people across very different cultural perceptions. You know, not only is the language different, but the way of looking at the world is different. And for a brash person, a brash white person who is trying to learn how to become a reporter, I made a lot of serious mistakes in trying to talk to people from the Yupik culture, because there are things that are just that don't translate. And one of them, for instance, is a proper reverence toward elders. In the Yupik Eskimo culture, a younger person never looks an older person in the eye when you speak to him because it's considered disrespectful. And as a reporter, of course, you're always looking people in the eye, and not only that, you're always shoving a microphone into their face. And it took me a long time to understand why people were very reticent when I went to speak to them. And fortunately, I had people who guided me through this and taught me that. And so when I did these other assignments in Iraq or in Afghanistan, for instance, I had already learned one thing, and that is that people do not perceive the world in the same ways. And, you know, you have to be very careful and very patient and very respectful, you know, in order to deal with them properly.
And we'll get to Christina in one more question. But so how did you get then from Alaska to NPR?
So the truth is that for many reporters who get a big job boost, it often comes from a disaster or a catastrophe of some kind. And mine was the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound in Alaska. I covered that. I was in Anchorage at the time, and I covered that for NPR, and it gave me the connections that I needed until finally NPR invited me to come down and do some work for them. So that was my start, essentially.
And then we'll talk a little bit later about how you got to your foreign correspondent gig from the newscast desk, which many of you probably remember the voice of Corey Flintoff as the voice of newscasts for 17 years. He was always my model. I tried to sound like him when I came to public radio. Clearly, it didn't work. But he was the voice, as far as I'm concerned. Christina, you were born in 1987, 4 years before the collapse of the Cuban economy in the post-Soviet era, 3 years before Corey arrived at NPR. So tell us about how you made the move from studying journalism at the University of Havana into the anchor desk of the National Evening News.
Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, I liked, when I was growing up, I liked to write, and I live in a country in which everything is about politics. Baseball is about politics. Cars on the streets is about politics. Why do we have 50 years old cars on the streets, American cars and Russian cars on the streets? So everything was through a political explanation. So it was part of my life. So if you had a sense of what's going on around you, you needed to be part of politics. And journalism was a way to express myself and to gain some tools to understand what was going on around me, far beyond the perspective of my parents or my outspoken politicians when I was growing up. And I got into journalism, very hard to get in. We have tests to get into the university. And when I graduated, I had the opportunity to choose where to go. And I could have gone to a newspaper, to a magazine, but Cuba is a country of television. Essentially, although we are a quite developed country in terms of radio, television has by far the most important role in terms of consuming information, entertainment. And the perspective during those 5 years was that we needed to change the media that we have. We needed a more profound, better journalism. And when you have that kind of goal and professors put that seed in you, you should be consequent with that and do it not in a comfortable writing articles about the last art exposition, which is great, but it's definitely something that you deliver once a month. So it was more intense, it was more engaging if you would go to the front line of that battle, which was television. And when I entered, my classmates choose art coverage, sports coverage. Not a lot of people wanted to go into politics. And it was harder, it was more complicated, and it all always puts you in the center of the attention, so that the mistake that you might commit, it will be the last mistake that you will commit. So it was not, let's say, a comfortable situation, but I decided to go there because my mother always tells me that fear is not in my dictionary, and it's not. And I believe that fear, not being irresponsible, but you have to go. I was educated on the premise that I had all these tools to understand the world, and I needed to go there and use them, not just be in a comfortable position. And then the generational gap helped me too, hard work, and that's why I was working live, doing lives in a morning show. I started in a morning show, waking up very, very early every day, and that gave me a lot of advantage and a lot of training very quickly in my life. And then, not even without dreaming about it, I graduated in 2011, and up to now I've covered probably the most important news of my country and of our region, not to say also of our region. And getting into U.S. domestics, I covered Cuba-U.S. relations, but also U.S. domestics, so elections, anything that happens here. I explained that to my audience in Cuba. So it's always a challenge, every day more. Essentially after November last year.
I was curious when we were talking earlier and you said it was difficult because culturally in Cuba, you're not going to go on television and talk about, you know, locker room humor, which you would have to mention if you're covering what's happened in the West.
I remember I was a student when Obama entered in the political scenario in 2008, and I decided I wanted to do my thesis about him. And I graduated with a paper about the political communication of his administration. And then I covered the 2012 election, working already. And the coverage, and journalists and you that are a well-informed audience, the coverage of a political process should be about the message, what a politician says is going to do, what are their ideologies, what's going to happen. And suddenly, in the last months, it's been about the ethical quality of the candidates. The debate is how good or bad are you at the recent thing that you did, and the behavior of those candidates. And it was hard because we don't cover Foot Locker, the kind of conversations and, let's say, non-political related issues that were central in these elections. And it's tremendously hard to explain that to a foreign audience, which, by the way, was very, very aware of the consequences of who would won in the U.S. elections or not, because whatever happens in this country affects Cuba too, and much more after Obama and Raul created all this context of engagement. So it's been hard covering the U.S. domestic politics more than before, I would say.
You've had to answer this question, especially on visits to the U.S., about this perception that of the government-owned Cuban journalism operations, that it's filtered, that positive stories are pushed, negative stories are discouraged. But you have made the case that there's a misperception about that. Characterize give us a more accurate, I guess, explanation of how it works.
Well, first of all, not everything that Cubans get to know is through us. And that's good. Because when I was growing up, all you had to watch was the 8 p.m. news show. That was our source of information. And that was it. No internet, no other alternatives in consuming information. But now it's absolutely different. First of all, there's alternative media, private media, which according to the Constitution is not legal, will exist anyway. And there's internet, which is growing and is there. And don't think about internet connection in Cuba as you have it here. For example, I have an internet connection because I'm a journalist. But that also means that my family has an internet connection. And my neighbors, when they need to communicate to the families, they use my internet connection. So that means that we have a network around one internet connection. So you have to think culturally speaking how Cuba works. So that's also a source of information all the time. And when I entered into journalism, political coverage was very, let's say, was made first by older men. You needed gray hair. and so when I appeared on TV, it was kind of, really? What do you have to say about it? So it was constructing legitimacy is still an everyday task. But I've never had the experience of you have to send this comment that you're going to do on camera to a person outside of my station. Of course I have bosses, I have editors. Editors with which I talk, I argue. I win that argument sometimes. Sometimes I lost that argument. I don't think that's different from any other context of the world. But I do believe it's a more open journalism. And it's a journalism in which we've grown to believe that if we had a monopoly over what people knew, we don't anymore. So we need to offer a better journalism. And I'm very happy every day when people tell me that they watch us because they, or me, or a colleague of mine, because they liked us, not because they're forced to watch us because we're the only one. So that perspective is changing rapidly. And also there's a big and intense debate inside the group of journalists in Cuba because of what you started this talk with, the public perspective. And there's a constant confusion. According to the Constitution, it's public media. So I always have that in my mind. And I remind that to the people that likes to say official media. My dream is to be more a public media and less an official media. That's not easy. That's not an easy evolution. But I think that the first step to solve a problem is recognizing that you have one. And there's a profound understanding, at least in my group of people, in the journalism community, we are quite influential in that sense because we speak with the top leaders of the country and we do say these same things that I'm telling you here right now. And the idea that should be public, not because we want to do whatever we want, not because we want to be rebels without causes, but because if we're not more public and more autonomy, we're going to be more official and so less watch. And we are in a context in which there's a lot of competition. And when a hurricane comes in and kills people in Cuba, people get to know that the hurricane is coming in because of Cuban National Television. So you need your people connected to their own media. So it's even a matter of national security, because if you don't have a true connection between your audience and the public media, which, by the way, is supposed to be paid by the people, and it's paid by the people, that's a big problem. So it's not a matter of I want protagonism or I don't want someone from the party telling me what to say. It's more complicated than that. And just to end up, being here, listening to Mark, seeing this video before, is tremendously inspirational to me. Because this is an example of how you can do good journalism, engaged journalism, with a sense of public service. I was trained to do journalism as a public service. I don't know how it's to make good money doing journalism. I don't know how it's to break for a commercial. I don't know. I wouldn't. I mean, it would have to be a great adjustment for me if I have to do it sometimes. And in Latin America, the experience of private media or context in which media is essentially or exclusively private, the experiences are awful. So I don't think we are a perfect model, but at least we should find a place in between, because definitely public and service to the people is the way to go.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Keith Shortall continues our conversation with Corey Flintoff and Christina Escobar.
Corey Flintoff, you launched from NPR from the newscast desks on a number of foreign correspondent gigs, but for tonight's purposes, we'll focus on Russia. You were there for 4 years in Moscow. And you would describe that experience as being very clearly, from the Russian government's perspective, very controlling. Not so much on you, but certainly on Russian journalists. But talk about what your experience was like.
Well, I think maybe the evolution that Christina is talking about has become a devolution in Russia. You know, it's as if they're going in the opposite direction. I arrived in 2012 during the big anti-government protests in Moscow and St. Petersburg. I was there after Putin returned to the presidency and began a campaign of very harsh repression against the domestic media and against opposition groups and against civil society groups. And I'm sorry to say that that's been extremely successful. He took over the state television channels. He co-opted the nominally independent television channels, and there are several of them there, by having them bought up by oligarchs who were sympathetic to the Kremlin. He destroyed a couple of independent newspapers and news television and news radio outlets, so that now there are very few independent sources of information. In fact, some of them are actually based in other countries. There's an online, a very good, incidentally, online news organization called Medusa that is based now in Riga, Latvia, composed of independent journalists who had to flee Russia and now are doing independent news, but from outside of Russia's borders. So it's amazing. And the degree of media control is something that's very hard for Americans, I think, to understand. As you probably know, Vladimir Putin has something like 83% approval rating in Russia. And that is absolutely genuine. But the reason for it is that he controls every news outlet in Russia, and every news outlet in Russia has nothing but positive coverage of him and his government. So it's a really disturbing situation, and one that one would not want to see repeated in our country or any other.
How were you treated, though, by government officials in your reporting of stories there?
You know, as a foreign correspondent, you know, I should say that it's rather dangerous to be a domestic reporter in a country like Russia, because something like 50 Russian reporters have been killed since the early 90s. But it's not especially difficult to be a foreign reporter there because you have the protection of being a foreigner. It's unlikely that if you, the worst thing that could happen to you really is that you could be ejected from the country. And that has happened to a few American and British journalists. But in general, they're less interested in cracking down on foreign media because foreign media is less of a threat to the government. NPR doesn't broadcast in Russia. We're available on the internet, but very few people seek us out from Russia. Our broadcasts are in English, so they're not available to most Russian people. So we're not considered a threat. So the only problem that I had, and it became an increasing problem over the 4 years or so that I was there, is that Russian government officials would not speak to me. They never tell you flat out, you may be familiar with this as well, they never tell you flat out that they're not going to speak to you. They always say, oh, we need to schedule, we need to talk to our bosses, we need to do this and we need to do that. And the object of all that is to make sure that you miss your deadline. So, and then they finally come along and they say, well, oh, we're so sorry, we didn't get to do it this time, next time we'll do it.
That actually happens in Maine as well.
Well, I had a Russian official who finally told me what the deal was. This was shortly before he left. He said, look, it's a lose-lose situation if I talk to you. Either I will say something wrong and my bosses will come down on me for it, or you being a untrustworthy foreigner will misinterpret me and make me look bad. So once again, my bosses will come down on me. There's no way I can win, so there's no percentage in me talking to you.
But you were you assumed that you were being maybe your phone calls were being monitored or your or,
yes.
And I heard a story about two gentlemen followed you around at one point for
the
a while.
Two.
I'm sorry.
Two men who followed you around.
Oh yes. Well, yeah, we were very seldom followed when we were in places. But when you go to more provincial places or places that have military installations, you're more likely to attract attention if you're a foreigner. And this was in Kaliningrad, you know, which is an exclave of Russia. It's a small piece of territory between Lithuania and Poland that now belongs to Russia. And it's become a very important military installation for them, where they've put a lot of very powerful missiles, especially anti-aircraft missiles, in this area. So they have a military reason for keeping secrets there. But no, we found from the minute we got off the plane that we were followed by a couple of guys who were sort of like Abbott and Costello. And these guys would turn up in the hotel in the morning. You know, they'd be sitting there in the lobby, and you know, you'd see them at various points throughout the day. Well, Kaliningrad is one of these cities that has a lot of canals and bridges, and so it's very easy to get lost there. And my Russian producer and I were walking across one of these bridges, and we turned out that we'd made a wrong turn. So as soon as we discovered it, we immediately wheeled around. And here's our two guys standing right behind us. And so they had to pick up their phones and suddenly become very interested in their phones and, you know, to make sure they didn't actually talk to us or make eye contact.
Obviously, this investigation, it's ongoing into allegations that the Russians tried to influence the 2016 election. Christina, how did you play that story in your news?
I was not ready for that question. Well, using the same words that you have in English, allege, Moscow hasn't confirmed this. But from a perspective of non-engagement, I mean, not taking sides, and I think that's something that the coverage of the U.S. in Cuba has improved too, in the sense that we covered the U.S. political world as a dark situation in which always something bad would come out to Cuba. And since Obama, we've been trying to do a more profound, unbiased perspective through which, for example, you would explain to the people how the system of political foreign policy decisions work, and you would give more information and more perspective. And this is one of the issues. For example, explaining to an audience in Cuba that some server that a candidate used for emails was actually an issue so big that could cost her the elections. Someone outside this context is tremendously hard to understand that that's actually an issue. And emails that she sent using a technology that was not allowed to use, and she raised and now doesn't exist, but anyway, it could cost her the job. So it's tremendously hard to explain this, but my goal into U.S. domestic coverage is always, since I'm on charge of this, is less political biased, more information, wait and see. Even with Trump, we waited, of course, then he proved us right. But at least we gave him the benefit of the doubt. In the past, no other president would have had the benefit of the doubt. Not even Obama. That was kind of interesting because of his origins and how different he was for the political context of the U.S. But we covered, of course, the idea that Russia might be in between this. But as you know, Russia and Cuba has very good relations in terms of economically speaking, and a good dialogue politically speaking. It's not like it was in the past, but it's a good partner. And the natural partner of Cuba should be the U.S., and it's not because of the political circumstances. So you need to be very skillful at looking for other partners and taking advantage of that links to, because you need to live in a world in which the embargo, for example, prevents Cuba from using US dollars, so, which is the international currency. So just one of the problems that Cuba has facing the international economic scenario. So you need friends. You can't mm-hmm. just give it back to anyone which you might have some kind of contradiction.
You might not. I don't know whether your work in Russia coincided with any of this developing story. But when were you out of there by this time? Or?
No, because for the last year and a half or so that we were there, that's when you began to see the formation of troll farms, and in fact, that became a big story for us. And as a matter of fact, where my wife and I lived, we lived right next door to a big office complex that was overnight filled with young people and computers who were tapping away night and day in this place. And every time we'd go by, you could see a window open here and there, and sure enough, they'd all be working away in there with their headphones and their computers. And it turned out to be a troll farm. These were people whose job was both to influence Russian domestic internet activity and international internet activity. And in fact, these places would rise up like mushrooms. They'd be in business for 6 or 7 months. They'd start to attract attention. They would suddenly fold, and then they'd reappear somewhere else. It turned out to be a very lucrative thing for young people in Russia who spoke good English, because those are the people who I believe the U.S. intelligence estimate, the people who ultimately turned up, on various forums and so forth in the United States, together with an absolute army of bots that had helped to amplify their messages.
But doesn't sound like a government operation, though, or do you have a sense of who was at the helm of that sort of thing?
Well, you have to ask yourself who benefits from this kind of thing. I mean, it's an expensive undertaking to have a farm full of people, you know, dedicated to influencing the internet. It's not something I can imagine a private party undertaking.
Were you able to get inside that in any way?
No.
No.
in no uncertain terms. A few people, and this is because the Russian opposition, although it is very weak and very fragmented, has a lot of very effective people. And Russians, as we know, are extremely talented when it comes to internet activity. And so people in the Russian opposition are equally talented, and so they're the ones who typically were able to expose these operations as trolling operations.
But that's an incredibly risky
it is.
Job being an opposition
Absolutely.
Journalist, yeah, as you had said earlier. Christina, I want to ask you about and you've hinted at this a couple of times, the generational differences in Cuba. As you mentioned, it was a surprise for many to see someone like you on the television. But there are, I guess, without overgeneralizing, there are real differences in the way that each generation might want to see the pace of change in Cuba and what kind of change. But there's still a broad feeling of nationalism, which is sort of Cuba first among all Cubans. Is that fairly characterizing it?
I think it's very clear that the younger generations want to keep the good things that we have, which is a very far away task to our foreign, to our neighbors around us, talking about safety, non-drug environment, education, free and quality, healthcare, a lot of things which are dreams for all the countries. But at the same time, there's a lot of challenges, the life quality of Cuba because of the economic crisis, the embargo, our own mistakes, how we are a poor country. All of that together has created a situation of life conditions to which people really feel worried about, and a lot of people immigrate, a lot of people try to find solutions outside of, I don't know, for example, being in Cuba, being a private worker as a taxi driver or renting your house, it's much more profitable than being a doctor. So it's a very big problem, a very big contradiction, and it's actually a burden and a problem in our society. But there's a common sense that we need to keep the good things and we need to improve those to keep Cubans inside Cuba, to create a standard of happiness in our country. No one wants to leave their country just because. There's always a reason behind that. And that's something we are very worried about. Nevertheless, how do you open, for example, open up the economy to private initiative and at the same time keep the big services to under the state control and the state budget? How do you divide that? I mean, the path is not clear and there's contradiction. I do believe even inside the Cuban government, the Cuban state, there's contradiction about this. Not everyone thinks the same. And I do believe that President Raul Castro has had to fight this battle because he deeply believes that we need to find alternatives to create economic incentive to improve quality lives. But of course, there's a generational perspective. My parents grew up in a society in which they were told that the collective property, that the social property, that was the way to go. That having a private, having more than one house, or having more than you need, or all of that, it was kind of weird. So of course, there's a sense of distrust, there's a sense of uncertainty about that. But I think the recent examples of the last years has proven that we need to create alternatives, economically speaking, to open up our economy, to improve our quality lives. And it has happened through the program of private initiative, more private business, a small private business, but which give employment and decent money to the people that decide to create this type of businesses. And I think, I don't like to believe that it's only a generational matter. We were over this in Maine calling today, because as I told the other guest that was on the phone, Raul Castro shaked Obama's hand and called him an honest man. And Marco Rubio, which is very young, speaks like he was born in the 50s. So it's not only about generation. I think it's up to the role in which you are in your historic moment. Everyone knows what should be doing. And I think it's more about the role that we have in the Cuban society and not exclusively related to the generation in which you are.
And there's a great sense of uncertainty because Raul Castro's term has a finite end that's upcoming. And what happens after that, I guess, is anybody's guess.
Of course, there's a lot of questions inside and outside Cuba. February 24th, he's stepping out of being the head of the government. Someone else will take over. There will be elections. The election system is under discussion to change. I don't know who's going to be, but there's the perspective that should be the person that looks to be groomed, which is the first vice president of the country, a very smart man. His name is Miguel Díaz-Canel. He's a quite interesting figure, but my big uncertainty or question is not so much about who's going to be the president of Cuba February 2005, the next day. I wonder more who's going to be the next one, when the historical generation of Raul Castro and others of his generation, which participated in the war back in the 50s, who released Cuba from an awful dictatorship of Fulgencio Batista. That myth that all this generation has around them, because they are war heroes, because they freed the country from that awful dictatorship and built the revolutions with a lot of accomplishments and a lot of debts and a lot of undone tasks too. When this generation is not around anymore, who's going to be that next person? That's my big question, my big uncertainty. And why I'm so worried, I'm so anxious to see a stronger media, public autonomy media, to face this big challenge. Because a political challenge is in the very, very first place, and you all know this very well, it's a communicational challenge. And we are far away from understanding that and taking actions to solve that first part? Because you might have the best politician in the world, and if you don't have the means to link them to their audience, to their people, you're lost. So a lot to do. I'm very excited, worried, but it's my generation. It's on my shoulders, generation. And it's exciting. Well, I think we should focus more on the opportunities and less on the on what we won't have or on the uncertainties.
Okay, audience questions next. But Corey, how do you see, this is a difficult question, but what's next for the future of Russia under Putin that you've described as essentially a criminal enterprise? Where do we go from here?
Now, I'm sorry to say that I think the immediate future of Russia is going to be more stagnation. President Putin has shown no indication that he plans to step down. His next election comes up in 2018. He is virtually certain to be reelected for another 6 years. And I think that as long as Putin and the Putin circle are in charge in Russia, I think that we're going to see increasing repression, increasing isolation, increasing stagnation in the economy and in the political life. When I left Russia, I left with the very depressing idea that I thought that the opposition had been basically completely smothered. But in March and in June of this year, there were enormous opposition protests, not just in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but in more than 100 Russian cities. And those protests were attended not by the usual, you know, I went to a lot of protests in Moscow, for instance, but they were very small, and they're typically, I got so that I recognized the people there, and they all were as gray-headed as I am. But these protests that have come up lately are attended widely by young people. They're very large and very active, and they're triggered primarily by anger over government corruption. And I think that's something that's going to be a significant factor in the next 5 or 6 years, and we'll see whether that develops into a significant opposition.
All right, we're going to move to some audience questions. Let's start over here on this side, please.
I have a question, one for Mr. Flintoff, being that you say that Russia is going to become more and more isolated, but there is increasing evidence that Russia has been involved with their trolls in affecting the media here, which may have affected our election, which is sort of getting their tentacles into and affecting the direction of our politics. So how does that affect, when you say isolated, is there isolation grabbing us and pulling them in? My second question is regarding Cuba. And you're talking about the younger generation, and they tend to get streaming news or through Facebook. So how do you reach out to the future when the news that they get, young people get, is coming from a very unfact-checked source?
Yeah. Can you
Thank
remember
you.
That, Bart?
Yeah.
Okay.
Corey,
go first.
The first question. I think the isolation is going to come in reaction, from countries not only like the United States, but also for the countries of Western and Eastern Europe that have been affected by Russian meddling in their elections. And I think that, you know, ultimately all these countries are going to realize that we have to defend ourselves against cyber meddling and that kind of thing. And I think we'll find a way to do it. But, in the meantime, they've successfully interfered in elections in Eastern European countries, such as Hungary and the Czech Republic. They've put in pro-Russian leaders there. And I think that's something that we have to worry about a lot.
Okay, my question is for Christina. And first of all, welcome to Maine.
Thank you.
Yeah. And it's a personal question. My daughter is a junior in college, and in January she will be going to Havana to study at the University of Havana as part of a study abroad program. So she's fine, you know, she's not worried. I'm her mother.
So you are.
And,
so you are.
You know, And so, you know, you said you graduated from the University of Havana. So I'm thinking with what we hear about the strange sonic attacks and the tensions, you know, people being pulled out of the embassy and all that stuff, what is the attitude of the regular Cuban college student towards Americans? What kind of reaction is she likely to face?
Well, I will give you just a few examples. First, I said this morning, I believe. I grew up and learned my first lessons of English listening to Backstreet Boys.
Okay.
So, American culture, American world is part of my culture. And so are you. And so are the people that come over, and it's like a big party all the time. So,
okay, now I'm really worried.
In that sense, you don't have to worry about it. And about what you just asked, and thank you for bringing the topic here. When we were covering the latest events around the incidents through which a group of American diplomats ailments around in some kind of, they call it attack, but they haven't found the source of the attack or the technology, so it's not an attack if you don't find those things, but they have some kind of symptoms unexplicable yet. But in the very moment in which they were withdrawing the U.S. diplomats, I'm a friend on Facebook with the second chief of the U.S. Embassy in Havana, and he was posting all his nostalgia for leaving Cuba and how many friends he was leaving behind and how happy his kids were in Cuba. And I did not use that publicly, but it's like, okay, you're leaving because you're under attack, but you're posting that you are sad for leaving and having lived probably the happiest years of your working life in this country. It's inexplicable. I'm not denying it happened, but we don't know what happened. And what we do know, it only affected this very small amount of group of diplomats. No any other American visitor had any kind of symptom. You know, America, the people-to-people engagement created by Clinton, that's not, Obama did not invent that, created by Clinton, the purpose was to change Cuba because you Americans would come over with your culture, which we have there, probably more than you. So you would come over and change Cuba. And the result, and I've met with several groups of Americans, and the result is always that the changed ones are not the Cubans.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a terrific experience. All the good luck for her, and reach me out if she needs anything in Cuba. Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're running up on time. Can we do a quick one? And then,
I'll try. My question is for the American journalists, but it was stimulated by Christina's remark about how difficult it is to explain to the Cuban people about the locker room talk and the emails. And I have trouble understanding that too, so I wish you could explain it to me. Donald Trump talks potty, and he says outrageous things, and he tweets outrageous tweets, and I do not think he is clueless. I think he knows exactly what he is doing. He is grabbing the headlines, and he is creating a cycle of news stories which will create a distraction from the very grave issues that we have in the United States today, which I don't think I have to enumerate. But that is a dance that requires a partner. And my question is, why do putatively responsible journalists enter into that dance and allow the distraction.
Corey, I think she meant it for you.
You know, I have to say that I think that the journalistic organizations in the United States made a terrible mistake early on in over-covering Donald Trump's campaign. I think it was a really serious mistake, and it was that tendency to go after low-hanging fruit that has a certain amount of perverse entertainment value, draws clicks, draws viewers, and I think that's something that was a real disservice to our listening publics. I think that did more than meddling by any foreign body. I think the fact that he was given so much free publicity. And I also think that the attacks against Hillary Clinton were given so much attention. You know, the New York Times is one, for instance. And I think that in that case, it was an editorial decision to say that this is the front runner, this is the person who's the expected president, this is someone we have to stand up to and show that we are not biased, and therefore we're going to cover all the, even the most baseless allegations against this person. So I think that was another element in the coverage that was very detrimental in this last election cycle.
And we're going to end it there. Thanks so much, Corey Flintoff.
Thank you.
And Christina Escobar.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today we heard from NPR's former Russia correspondent Corey Flintoff and Cuban state TV anchor Christina Escobar. They recently spoke with Keith Shortall on the meaning of public media abroad at the Portland Museum of Art. You can listen to this program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to access the program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine. And for Speaking in Maine, I'm Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.